Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, acclaimed science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer's latest book out through Shadowpaw Press is The Downloaded. He joins me to discuss it. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you so much, Michael. Glad to be here.
My pleasure to have you on. So I'm very curious, with a book like this, is there like a grand concept first, or like what's the like kernel or idea that prompts a book like this?
100% for me as a writer, it is the concept, the theme, the central notion first, and everything else is secondary. The Downloaded is my metaphoric response to the COVID-19 crisis. During real COVID-19, we were all metaphorically uploading into a virtual realm. We didn't go to the office or go to class. We took classes by distance education. We went to the office by telecommuting. We didn't go out to dinner. We had Uber Eats or whoever order the stuff in for us. We didn't see our friends in physicality. We saw them online. But we all knew that this was going to come to an end, not as fast as it should have because people were foolish during COVID, but it should have come to an end quite quickly. And we'd be forced to download back into real interaction with human beings. Well, that's metaphorically what happened. In science fiction, you often take the metaphoric and treat it as literal. And The Downloaded is about uploading people, literally, their consciousness into a quantum computer and they downloading back into physical reality and being forced to deal with real world stuff again.
So existing online, I mean, the move to, you know, remote learning, to Zoom meetings, you know, that could go any number of ways in terms of as a science fiction concept. How you gravitate to then, you know, going several hundred years in the future and it's like this quantum computer that people are being uploaded to for interstellar travel. How do you end up there from,
I'm doing a Zoom thing during COVID? As a science fiction writer, you're always looking for what's not necessarily the most likely thing that you can extrapolate, but the most entertaining thing that you can extrapolate that isn't contradicted by what we already know. And uploading into a quantum computer and freezing your body cryogenically, the other half of this equation in The Downloaded, made me ask the question, well, great, these technologies might indeed exist in a couple of decades. What are they good for? Well, obviously, and we've seen this many times in science fiction, it's in both 2001, A Space Odyssey, and the original Planet of the Apes, both of which came out in 1968, the freezing of astronauts, hibernation, so they can take a long, many, many space voyage and arrive hale and hearty. That makes sense, astronauts. So there's some of the characters in my book. But also I'm very interested in prison and rehabilitation. And we have a terrible track record of throwing people in jail. And our friends to the south, the Americans, have the worst track record on the planet. They have more people, not just per capita, more people as a gross number behind bars in the United States than any other country in the world, including the totalitarian regimes that we rail against. So in The Downloaded, I thought, well, what if you could upload the consciousness of prisoners, make it seem like their sentence, say 20 years, had passed, but only a very short period of time had passed in the real world, and then you download them again so that their kids haven't grown up, so that whatever job skill set they have isn't totally obsolete because decades have gone by. So you're looking for the dramatic characters that you can build into the premise that you've decided to explore.
So the incorporation of the prisoners being kind of one set of people uploaded, did that come early? Like, or was that something like, had you already kind of started writing the astronauts and then thought about, you know, who would play foil to those astronauts?
I definitely started writing the astronauts first, no question about that. And as I was doing that, the phrase, the right stuff, kept echoing in my mind. Now, this, of course, is Thomas Wolfe's book about the original Mercury 7 astronauts, made into a movie and more recently into a miniseries on TV. And yet, you know, that right stuff from the 1960s, today we would dismiss most of that as toxic masculinity, hyper-competitiveness, easy to take insult, demanding honor be satisfied in all occasions. And the prisoners that I've met in my real life, I've been lucky enough to interact with some prisoners in jails where they bring writers into the prison. I did this, for instance, in Whitehorse in the Yukon some years back. They did not intend to end up in prison. They did not intend to be dealt a bad hand. And society has said, well, they've got the wrong stuff. But I found that a lot of them had more humanity than these hyper masculine, toxic exemplars, supposedly, of what it should be that Tom Wolfe had called the right stuff. So it seemed a great contrast between those who history is branded as having the right stuff, but don't really, and those who the law has branded as having the wrong stuff, but in often cases are victims of circumstances.
In some ways, this book maybe makes the argument for it's just stuff and what situation that stuff is utilized in or who it's utilized by maybe presages whether it's considered right or wrong stuff.
You know, all ethics are to some degree situational, where what are the actual circumstances around them? You know, one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. Well, should you kill somebody who is about to kill another innocent person? You know, everything is more nuanced and subtle than it seems at first blush. And that's a great engine for writing fiction. You're looking for situations where what seems, oh yeah, I know this guy's guilty, this guy's innocent, I like this guy, I dislike this guy, and you flip it on its head, because that makes for interesting reading, that makes for dramatic conflict, that makes for literature. And science fiction, which is what I write, is very much, when done well, a part of literature.
So speaking of making interesting reading, I want to ask some structural questions. So the book is written as a series of interviews. And I'm very curious, was that something that you deigned upon early, or did that develop, like, had you written a draft where this was maybe told first person or in a more linear, like narrativized way? How did you kind of land on this as the structure and maybe more so why?
So The Downloaded is just out now in print and ebook. And in fact, on May 21st in Winnipeg, I'm going to be at McNally Robinson at Grant Park doing a reading from it. But it's been out for 6 months as an audiobook. The genesis of this project was that Audible approached me and said, would you write something original for us? And I said, yeah, I will if I can, you know, keep out the novel rights and the film and TV rights and vend those to other people. They said, yeah, that's fine. And we were all set to do a fully interactive, almost radio drama kind of thing, people talking back and forth, multiple characters in a scene, when Audible's attorneys said, wait a minute, flag on the play, COVID-19 crisis, we don't think our liability will cover having more than one actor in studio at a time. I thought we were sunk at that point. And then the producer director of The Downloaded, Gregory J. Sinclair, who sadly just passed away. The Downloaded was his last project, and had previously been the head of radio drama at the CBC, said one word to me, said Rashomon, which is a famous movie by Kurosawa about people giving individual testimonies to a judge that often contradict or sometimes complement what the previous witness has said. And I thought, that's perfect. That structure will work. So the structure, ironically, for this novel that is my metaphoric treatment of COVID-19 became the template for how the novel was written, was the reality of COVID-19.
Did the structure then inform how you told the story in a way that you hadn't experienced with, you know, writing a book in the traditional sense? Like, did you find that you were maybe economizing in some way because it would be someone talking rather than, you know, the interior dialogue that can often go on quite a lot longer than someone would speak for?
Yes, that's very interesting, because one of the great powers of narrative fiction normally is you hear so much of the inner thoughts of the character, not just the things they say out loud. And although there's certainly a good amount of that in The Downloaded, it is downplayed compared to what I would do in normal, even first-person narrative fiction. And that said, I've done, you know, novels with a first person narrator before. One of my best selling novels is something called Calculating God, told entirely from the first person of a dying paleontologist at Toronto's Royal Ontario Museum. But that's one first person narrator. In The Downloaded, there are 9 different first person narrators. And that's a particular challenge because not only do you have to, you know, have 9 different perspectives on the events, but you have to give each one a distinctive voice, not just in the audio version, which is easy with different actors. We had Brendan Fraser, we had Combe Fiore, we had wonderful cast, but also on the printed page, the words, the dialect, the diction, the cadence, everything has to be different for each of the 9 distinct characters.
So then do you find yourself mapping out or sketching out who these people are before you start writing from their perspective so that you have a good sense of voice? And by that, I don't mean, you know, Brendan Fraser's voice, but like the character's voice.
When I teach creative writing, I absolutely am an advocate for what you've called, which is plotting things out, planning ahead. But in the reality of my career, I've been very poor at that. I tend to be what's called a pantser, meaning that I fly by the seat of my pants. And absolutely, I created these characters as I was writing them. There were no character sketches. I know in a creative writing class, the professor would write a character sketch, write a biography, talk about what he ate for his favorite treat when he was a kid. All of that really is irrelevant until it counterpoints a dramatic situation. And so as I wrote my characters with their action, they would reach a point where at one point, one character just loses it and grabs a pair of garden shears and is going to stab another character in the chest. At that point, you make up the attendant details that make sense. The other character had called him, taunted him with the name that he had called the kid when he was a kid. And as an adult, hearing that again makes him snap. Well, you make that up in the moment as you're writing the action moment. What triggers it? Well, then you flesh out the character there. So for me, and it's part of the joy, I have to say, if I planned everything out in advance, then the actual act of writing becomes a mechanical task. The great director Alfred Hitchcock used to plan out so much in advance, shot by shot, with storyboards and camera angles, everything. So he said, if I die before the film is made, it will be made identically from my blueprint to how I would have executed it when we actually got on the sound stages. But for me, that would be anathema, to be sitting at my keyboard, writing these scenes and simply executing instructions that I'd already outlined for myself.
So in the case of a situation like the garden shears thing, you write that and then you're like, how did I arrive at this? And you start kind of figuring that out?
More or less, yes. You get to the dramatic moment that you need to have. This is the inciting incident of the whole novel. The guy actually does put the garden shears through the chest of his childhood tormentor and ends up quite rightly being arrested, quite rightly being jailed, quite rightly sentenced to 20 years, and then offered this pilot project that, wait a minute, if you agree to a virtual sentence, those 20 years will seem like 20 years to you, but we'll get you out again in just 18 months, and your little girl will still be a little girl. Your job will still be there. Your wife will not have run off with somebody else. And you get to the moment that you need dramatically, and then you figure out how to make it seem utterly inevitable that these wholly believable characters that you're building brick by brick would take that particular, in this case, disastrous action.
So speaking of being wholly believable, the science of things, right, like the quantum entanglement and the time dilation and the fact that, you know, these astronauts are supposed to be traveling at, you know, a specific light speed, but that the time they experience is only 1/20th of that. How much of that are you adhering to actual science, and how much do you throw caution to the wind and say, you know what, like maybe it's built on a flimsy thing, but for the purpose of story, I maybe will sacrifice some truth?
I never cheat. I am an absolute adherent to real science. I'm what they call a hard science fiction writer. That hard part doesn't mean that the books are hard to read or that you need an advanced degree to understand them. It means that whatever science there is, real science that there is in the books, is accurately portrayed. And any extrapolated future science is a realistic, plausible extrapolation of what we already know. Those constraints, my friend Gregory Benford, great American science fiction writer, calls that playing science fiction, as if you're playing tennis, playing with the net up. It's easy to play with the net down, tennis. Anybody can play the game. You put that net up and you're going to, you know, be easily beaten by anybody who's a better player than you. I firmly believe that the constraints force you into more creativity as a writer. So science fiction's power is that these are things that plausibly might happen. Fantasy, which I tend to be fairly dismissive of in my reading habits, and people ask me, you know, what's the difference between science fiction and fantasy? I say, science fiction good? And I leave it to the fill in the blank. But the blank is, fantasy is dismissible. Stories that could never possibly happen because they violate the reality of the world we live in are of no instructive use in one's life. I find them hard to get into, though, but that could never happen, right? I find that reaction turns off me as a reader, as a viewer, whatever medium I'm taking it in. In good science fiction, you're going, oh my God, this could be true. Wow, that could happen. Oh my, this is possible. This is plausible. This might be our future. That's the power of hard science fiction.
So then you hold to your, essentially, you're your first reader, so you have to buy it first.
I absolutely have to buy it first. I had a trilogy about the World Wide Web gaining consciousness called Wake, Watch, and Wonder. Came out in 2009, 10, and 11. Hugo nominee for Wake, other awards for the others, blah, blah, blah. That was the hardest thing for me to come up with a plausible scenario about how the World Wide Web, which now has more interconnections than the human brain has synapses, could gain consciousness. And I spent a year pounding my head against the wall and doing research and trying draft after draft until I got it right. And when I got it right, I was invited to the Googleplex, the headquarters of Google, and Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the founders of Google, sat in on my seminar about how the World Wide Web could gain consciousness. You have to get it right.
You have a kind of prospective event about privacy wars, essentially, that like the reason this computer is housed locally and not cloud-based, it comes about through, you know, people's concerns around privacy. Is this something that, you know, in researching, you glommed onto as an idea? Like, how did you arrive at something that...
This is something I've been talking about for an awfully long time. In 2002, I wrote a novel called Hominids, which went on to win the Hugo Award, science fiction's top honor, for best novel of the year. And it was all about testing this proposition of whether or not transparency versus personal privacy was a good thing. So I've been very much, this is not something I stumbled upon in my research. This is something that I've been one of the pioneers of talking about. And, you know, right now we have this reality where everybody who sells you software, and software has transitioned in my lifetime between something you license and own and the only copy and the only version of the data is on your computer to your data and the software itself being up in the cloud, software as service subscription, right? And that's because somebody else wants to monetize everything you're creating, or in our AI era, wants to scrape every document you've written so that it can better train AI to make money for them, not for you. But Moore's Law, Gordon Moore, in 1965, so we're coming up on the 60th anniversary of that next year, said, paraphrasing here, computing power doubles every 18 months. What he actually said at that point was every 2 years, the number of transistors you can cram onto a given area of substrate doubles. But it's a good barometer, and it became more fast than he thought it would be. So now we say every 18 months. Computing power doubling. There's no need to give your data to the cloud. There's plenty of terabytes or more of storage that you can buy cheaply. Your computer maybe have come with a terabyte hard disk drive in it if you bought it in 2024. Yet we freely have been giving away all our data. And my point is, no, at some point we're going to say, huh, I don't need a cloud. I've got more computing storage capacity and more processing power than anything I had ever want to do on my computer, including fully immersive virtual reality, would ever require. why would I share that data with somebody else who's going to monetize it?
So reincorporating topics you've been wrestling with in past works, it's not necessarily like a unified universe that you're creating, but like you're inculcating new works with the same ideas and wrestling with them in new ways?
Absolutely. I have been developing a number of themes in my fiction over the years. And you're right, I don't have a coherent universe. I've got 25 novels now, three trilogies of three. So nine of them are in three separate universes, and the other, the bulk of the rest of all the rest of them are singular creations in separate universes. But that said, the themes that interest me, science versus religion, the nature of human consciousness, is there some way to cheat death technologically? Do robots or other artificial intelligences deserve rights? All of these things I've been wrestling with for decades now. My first novel came out 34 years ago, and my thinking evolves as the world around us evolves. So some of what I said earlier, I may contradict later, but I'd like to think that is because I'm a science fiction writer. A scientist changes his, her, or their opinion and mindset based on whatever new information, new data, and new thinking comes forward. I like to think I have a nimble, agile mind. I want my readers to have a nimble, agile mind. So when one of them says to me, wait a minute, you said 20 years ago. Yeah, 20 years ago, that was my best guess. Now, buy today's book, because that's my best guess today.
You have a quotation from James Kerwin at the beginning of chapter one. It says, any civilization's collapse begins the moment its people start to ask themselves, does this bring me joy rather than does this bring others joy? Did you have that quotation before you started writing the book, or did you find that quotation during the writing of the book? I'm very curious about, like, was this a jumping off point for you or a summation of something that you'd already at that point written?
This was a summation. James Kerwin is an extremely talented American, lives in Los Angeles, independent film writer, producer, director. And many years ago, he wrote and directed a fabulous independent science fiction film called Yesterday Was a Lie, about the nature of consciousness. It's done in stylish black and white as a noir science fiction detective thriller. People will recognize Chase Masterson, who was part of the recurring cast on Deep Space Nine, and Peter Mayhew, who played Chewbacca, as the actors who are in the film, among the actors who are in the film. And I follow James on Twitter, now X, and he posted that one day on it. And I said, wow, I agree with that. Any civilization's collapse does begin the moment people start asking themselves, does this make me happy instead of does this make other people happy? I said, hey, James, is that original to you? Yeah, I just made that up. Can I use it? And indeed, he gave me his permission, and it's the epigraph for the book, because we were just so simpatico in our thinking. It wasn't the jumping off point, but boy, it was the perfect summation of not just what I wanted to say in my current book, The Downloaded, but what I've been saying in many of my works.
What people owe to society, or being part of a society, entails thinking about others more
totally.
So than yourself.
And one of the biggest themes in my fiction comes out of my own personal past. I happen to be a Canadian by birth. I was born in Ottawa, but I'm also an American because my mother was an American temporarily in Canada, went to the embassy in Ottawa and said, I've had a foreign soil birth. Please give my child American citizenship. And back in the day, that was all it took. So I have these two heritages, which is why Spock on Star Trek with his human and Vulcan heritage so appealed to me. And a large part of my fiction is about contrasting stereotypical Canadian values versus stereotypical American values. And that quote by James Kerwin speaks directly to that. The stereotypical American values from their founding documents are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They're individualistic. The stereotypical Canadian values are peace, order, and good government. They're collectivist. And I come out time and time again on the need, to quote Spock, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. I'm a collectivist at heart.
Is that why prison reform and rehabilitation is a topic that you address in this book, and that it appeals to you as an idea, that it's a more collectivist approach to individual action?
Absolutely. I'm fascinated. I've never been arrested. I've never gone to jail, but I've had friends who have served time. And I'm fascinated by our continuing for centuries to say, you've done something wrong. We don't know what to do with you. We're going to put you in jail. And then they come out, in many cases, more hardened criminals, not rehabilitated. It's not all about rehabilitation. And many years ago, I was lucky enough to visit a prison in Whitehorse in the Yukon. When I was on tour for a different book, I was at a writer's festival. They said, hey, we have a writers in the prisons program. Want to come along? What an enlightening day to spend talking to people who had been jailed, who did not intend, of course, to be jailed, who did not intend to have lives of crime, and ask them about their aspirations and their hopes. And I've had a great deal of sympathy for the incarcerated ever since. And science fiction, I always say, is a laboratory for thought experiments about things that would be unethical, impracticable, or illegal to test in real life. But it's a great test bed for alternatives to traditional crime and punishment, traditional incarceration. And this particular novel just seemed a great opportunity to contrast the astronauts and the prisoners and explore alternatives to just throwing somebody away and locking the door behind them.
Well, speaking of alternative methods, you incorporate the Clockwork Orange method of, you know, revisiting your crimes. Do you see something in film or in other works that you're like, ah, yeah, I want to incorporate that into my own work to kind of question how it would work within the world I build?
All of science fiction is a dialogue with all other science fiction. And the most famous example is Joe Haldeman, who wrote of his Vietnam War experiences in a novel that won the Hugo Award called The Forever War, in contrast with Robert A. Heinlein's novel Starship Troopers about his World War II experiences, also a Hugo Award winner. And, you know, Heinlein said it made a great man out of me, and Haldeman said it was the living hell of my life. In fact, back to COVID, he said, I can't believe people are saying, oh my God, this year of COVID lockdown was the worst possible part of my life. I envy you, because I was a NAM. I envy you who get to say something like that, something so inconsequential as not getting to go out to dinner and having to telecommute to the office was a living hell for you. I've been, says Joe, in a living hell. So yeah, I'm a huge Stanley Kubrick fan, but Clockwork Orange is not a film that I like. And who can like it? It's brilliant, but it is absolutely destroying to watch it. It is so violent, so brutal. And the notion that, you know, Alex is forced with his, Alex the Droog, the main character of Clockwork Orange, with his eyes propped open to constantly rewatch what he had seen, that is cruel and unusual punishment and probably should be barred. But the notion that, now, let's go back, let's ask ourselves, in that circumstance, here's what you did, let's look at it again and ask yourself, why did you lose your cool at this point? Why did you grab the garden shears? Could you have aborted before you actually thrust them into the man's chest? How will you deal with any similar provocation once you get out? That kind of therapeutic revisitation of the past, I think, is enormously helpful.
Well, the book raises lots of questions. Hopefully you'll provide some answers at McNally on the 21st. The download is out through Shadow Paw Press right now. Robert J. Sawyer, congratulations on the release, and thanks for joining me on the program.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you.